Chicago at the O'Hare Inn, the Hilton, whatever that hotel is, right at the airport. So I went over there, and we went in a regular room. It had a double bed, and it had a little cocktail table, two chairs. So the president of the Green Bay Packers sat in one chair, and I sat here, and the bed was there, and Tom Bratz, the GM, sat on the bed. And we talked, and we talked, and we talked, and they offered me the job. I accepted the job. I said, but you can't say anything until I get back home. I'm not going to call Doug Weaver up and tell him I got to go see him in person, because if I just can't do that to him on the phone. So we agreed. I got up the next morning rather early because I didn't want to run into these guys. I already had the job, but I didn't want to screw it up. So went to the airport, O'Hare, and just found out, where's the next plane going, either Detroit, Grand Rapids, or Lansing, anyone. I got out of there. Damn if I don't have to go to Detroit, and I'm getting off the plane, and who do I run into? An old baseball player, Charlie Papa Maxwell. I don't know Charlie, but he recognizes me. And I got to get back to Lansing. He wants to talk, and we're talking and talking and talking. I enjoyed talking to him because I've known about him so long. And get picked up, go back to Lansing. And so called Doug Weaver. He comes over. Not this house, we had another house. And we go down the basement, and we talk, and we talk, and we talk, and it's about 5 o'clock, so we send my wife and his wife out to get ribs, and we start having drinks. And pretty soon, he's got to go home. Roger Wilkinson comes over, and he's got tears in his eyes, and he's hugging me. David Scott's the provost. He's calling. He says, we got to keep our stars. We have... deans around here and professors around here, we have to keep, they're our stars, and you're a star, and we got to keep you and all this. So I'm down the basement, and finally I had to answer the machine on the bar down there so I could screen the calls. And Joe Farrell calls. He's a close friend. He works for the school, and he's basically a lobbyist for the medical school. And I said, Joe, I'm so sick of this phone. Oh, while I'm on down there, Frank Kelly is a close friend. He's with the governor, Blanchard, coming back from Detroit. And they're, you can't leave. We'll shoot ourselves in the foot right after the Rose Bowl. You leave, they'll screw everything up, Blanchard's saying. Frank says, I'll be over to see you. So the phone rings, Joe Farrell calls, and I said, Joe, I am so tired of this telephone. If you want to talk, get your ass over here. He only lived a mile away. So he came over, and we're talking. I said, you know what amazes me? I've been down this basement since noon. Now it's about 9 o'clock. I said, I've talked to everybody, and no one's offered 5 cents, not a nickel. I can't believe that. I said, not that I would take it. So now Frank comes in. And so Joe repeats what I said to him to Frank. So Frank goes over to the bar where the phone is. He grabs the phone. And he calls Larry Owen, who's chairman of the board of trustees. He says, Larry, I want the votes for George because, oh, what did I want? Frank's talking to me before he gets on the phone. I said, Frank, if I was staying here, I'm going to be 62 in 8.5 years. I want an 8.5 year contract, and I want an annuity to make sure Sally's taken care of. And the same as I would have with the in the pros. And that was basically a $45,000 a year annuity in 5 years. So Frank calls and says, I want this, and I want those votes, and I want them tonight. He's telling Larry Owen, who's chairman of the board. So Larry calls back at midnight, says, it's all done. And we'll see George tomorrow morning. Well, as it was, he didn't have the votes at midnight. He said that, but he got them like 2 or 3 in the morning. And so the next morning, Frank, Joe Farrell, and Larry Owen came over to my house. And so I called Sally over. I said, they're going to give me, they talked to Breslin before they came over. Breslin said, are you nuts? 8.5 years? We'll look like goofs. Make it 10 years. So they're offering me a 10-year contract. They're offering me a $45,000 a year annuity the rest of my life and her life. And that would take me to about 64 years old. So I said, Sally, she said, whatever you want to do. And so I stayed, which was probably a mistake, because then the shit hit the fan. Because now DiBiagio's in another country. I forget where.
Thailand, I think.
And David Scott is making decisions. When he finds out that I got a 10-year contract that he knew nothing about, and I got an annuity that he didn't have, he was pissed off and tried to find out if it was could be void. Well, what happened, Frank knew what he was doing, because I thought that Larry Olin had the power to do this, that made it a legal contract. Because I thought Larry was chairman of the board, he really didn't. And so DiBiagio couldn't fight it. But from then on, boy, he took it out on me. And so that was the end of that. And then 2 years later, Doug was going to retire, Weaver. And I wanted to be AD for the simple reason, and Jed wanted me to be AD, and so did Ron Mason, because we didn't know who they might hire, come in and just change everything around, and just the insecurities you have wanting to keep things going, because Doug was a great AD for us. So I wanted the job, and so I had to get my pack up, walk over to see DiBiagio, tell him I wanted an interview, and it was all hokey pokey. When we were over at the Hula Bowl, DiBiagio said, go see Roger, he's the one in charge. They were passing me around a little bit. Poor Roger, he didn't know what to do. He was just taking his orders from DiBiagio. DiBiagio wanted no part of it. So when the Jets offered me the position, I went to New York, and I had to negotiate with the general manager on one side, and then behind on this side of the table, him and I, and the president from he was the owner's main guy. He didn't keep an office at the football building. He was a tough New York negotiator, and he was trying to beat me up, and I wasn't budging a bit because I already had something good at home, and so I finally got the deal I wanted. We agreed, and we went over to the table in his office, and we were starting to work on some football business. And he said, before you leave here, this isn't a contract, but this says everything in it, so in case you get with a truck, we got this down. But before you sign it, you better get permission from Michigan State. We don't want them to sue us. So I went down to another office by myself, and I called Doug Weaver. He wasn't in. He was over at the health center. He was over getting a treadmill test. So I called Roger. Larry Owen was in Roger's office with Kathy Wilbur. They're trying to get that vote to make me AD. And so he says, I don't have it yet, but I'm going to get it. Call me back in 45 minutes. So I went back down to that office, told him I had to call back in 45 minutes. I called back in 45 minutes. And he said, we got it. Come on home. Well, so I went back and told him, you better call Larry Owen. They're not going to let me go. I didn't want to go then. I wanted to be AD and head coach. So I came home, and they had an emergency meeting that night over at Kellogg. And I was live on TV.
I remember that.
And so I was over at one. I slipped out the door and was over at one of my assistant coaches' house down in the basement watching it. The whole staff was there because it's their livelihood. And the vote came where I was AD. Now, holy Christ, DiBiagio was furious. We, before the year was up, he got the board to make a resolution that one person couldn't have two positions. So I had to choose. They all assumed I was going to choose AD. But I would have chosen AD if they let me finish the last season so these coaches could have a chance to regroup. But I had to make a decision right then, so I decided to be a football coach. And then that's when DiBiagio hired Mary Lee and left a day later. At which, you know, he was, ever, but what happened, that Green Bay thing really wrecked our relationship. We were decent friends before that, but he was teed off at that. And had I known all that, that who's running, who's going to be mad, who isn't, and I'd have got the hell out and gone to Green Bay. I would have said, that's the reason I should have gone to Green Bay. I shouldn't have gone to Green Bay for money, or I shouldn't have gone to Green Bay for any other reason than eliminate all that controversy, which wasn't tough on me because I've been in the arena for a long time, but it really was tough on my wife. I mean, it was tough on her hearing that noise. It's like watching a game in the stands. It's tougher than being on the field. Hell, you're involved. You got things to do. When you're sitting in the stands, she had to hear all that noise. And it wasn't fun for her. But like everything else, time heals. And
when you were athletic director, what your attitude toward the non-revenue sports?
Well, it's like when I went to St. Ambrose. I followed a coach in there, Tom Boyce, and had championship teams. There was no room for improvement on the field. The only room for improvement was with the principal, the nun, and the relationship with her, because Tom was winning, and he didn't get along with her. So I capitalized on that and making sure we had a good relationship and brought her into the fold. When I went to, what was the question?
I was asking about non-revenue sports.
Oh.
While you were AD.
Doug Weaver was a great AD, but he told him, I take care of football, I take care of hockey, and I take care of basketball. The rest of you, when he hired him, he'd say, just be competitive, try to win half of them. I'm not giving you the full budget. I'm not going to give you that. Don't ask for it. And so non-revenue were struggling financially. So when I was AD, the best place for the morale of the athletic department was to give more to non-revenue sports. I needed nothing in football. Judd needed nothing. Mason needed nothing. So when we would have, we watched the budget pretty close. I think the first year, we were a plus $1.5 million. The second year, we were 1.8. So I had money to give to non-revenue sports. And it was amazing. It wasn't that much, but the little bit they appreciated. And they have a big voice because they have numbers. And they were beating my drums just for the little bit I did for them. That's where, you're a good athletic director. What's that mean? That means you keep the books in order, that you end up in the black, that you don't have any violations and this and that. But where the drums were really beaten were all those non-revenue sports. And it was only because when Doug came in, the school was in the red. He couldn't take care of them. He had to get this going. Now, he was just about ready to do what he did, but he left. So I got credit for taking care of them because he didn't, but he couldn't. He could have when I did. So that's really the truth on why I got a good grade as far as AD. It was because of the positive things that the non-revenue said about me.
Well, how would you characterize your relationship with Judd Heathcote and Ron Mason?
Excellent. They loved it because every time I'd see Judd, what do you need? Nothing. Ron, what do you need? Nothing. They have everything they need. You always try and Judd and I are still, and Ron, we were very good friends to start with, so that was a no-brainer, having them as basketball and hockey coach. So everybody was happy that the three main sports were, the non-revenue was, we were making money, so everything was going smoothly. But I, before I became AD, I knew it 6 months ahead of time. So I spent every extra minute I had over in Doug's office sitting at a table like this while he was working, just sitting. When he'd get a call or when he was talking to the NCAA, I'd get on the other line and listen. So I had 6 months of preparation. And I learned from a good one, Doug.
You talked about a typical day for Duffy. How would you describe a typical day when you were head,
head coach?
would try to get there maybe 7:15, give myself 45 minutes in the morning to get whatever done. Get a cup of tea. First get in there, change from my street clothes to coaching clothes so I was ready for the day. Get a cup of tea, get behind my desk, and I might have half hour stuff to do. I might have 10 minutes stuff to do. I might not have much to do. Then I'd get another cup of tea and I'd go into the meeting room. And I'd like to sit there and look at, we always had the board there of the players, and just study it, who's hurt, who's going to be back next year, and always have an 8 o'clock meeting. My thinking was, if I meet at 8 o'clock, I don't have to hear about going to the dentist. I picked up the kids, I dropped the kids off, 8 o'clock meeting, every single day during the season. Now, the meeting might only last 2 minutes, but they're there. Everybody's on job. If you don't, got the red light, the bridge went up. I mean, there's all kinds of shit that happens. You know, you got so many people. 8 o'clock meeting, trainer there, equipment guy there, everybody accounted for. And maybe 5 after 8, that's it. See you guys. Well, it got to a point where some days I wouldn't have a whole lot to do. I'd get in the meeting room maybe 20 to 8, a cup of coffee, and these guys kept coming in early and early. We had actually, there was one occasion we started a meeting before 8, and we were done before 8 o'clock. Now, I had one coach, a good friend, still a good friend. He'd come in right at the wire. Every day he'd come in just at the wire. We had a phone on the wall, and it had the time on the phone. He'd come in, he'd beat it. He never was late, but that one day, we were done before he got there. I used to call him the afternoon shift guy. But he wasn't late, but he just... But always had a meeting during the season every day, so everybody was accounted for. And then we'd go. I let him coach. The first year I was real involved with defense because I was teaching the Stunt 4-3, the scheme. After the first year, I named Nick Saban the defensive coordinator, and I had... Morris Watts on offense, and I let those guys coach. I never criticized them in front of the players. I didn't look over their shoulder. They had a lot of leeway. They had what I had most of the time when I was coaching, and that's a good environment when you can coach your position. If you got anything to say, you have a meetings, and you might, you God damn it, we got to run the ball. You're monkeying around out there all day while we do it. Looks like basketball. And they'd get the message. And during the game, when I was on, I had a switch. I could go from offense to defense. And I'd go back and forth. They'd ask me, we're going to blitz. And they'd want permission to blitz sometimes. Nick Saban was famous for that, wanting permission to blitz. Because if it didn't work, it was going to be a big one. And when they wanted to blitz, I went with it. Morris, at times when we'd have the game pretty well wrapped up, keep it on the ground. I don't want to see that son of a bitch in the air anymore. We got this one. We're not trying to see how many points we can win by. We just want to win the game. We got them. I remember we were playing Indiana for the Rose. The winner goes to the Rose Bowl. And they went down and kicked the field goal there. We tie or we win, we go to the Rose Bowl. All we got to do is tie. They go down, they kick a field goal. We come and we got the ball on... like 8-yard line. It's 3rd down and 8. Now I'm scared. I know one thing. I'm getting a field goal and tie this son of a bitch, if nothing else. That's the worst that happened. So I make them run. It's such a bad call. 3rd and 8 from the 8. I mean, you got to be an idiot to run the ball there. The hole's so big because they're expecting the pass. We score a touchdown. I mean, that's how bad of a call it was. But it was... something they didn't expect. They didn't realize that I wasn't trying to win right there. I just wanted them to run, get tackled, and kick the field goal and tie the game up. Because we had Langlo, a pretty good kicker. But that's what I did. And then on offense, I substitute the running backs. I used to grab them, throw them in, hold them, and I get the feeling when they were hot, Lorenzo. I had always had pretty good running backs, and I'd substitute them.
Who are some of the players that you coach that you really have memories about?
Michigan State or pro?
Michigan State.
Well, Lorenzo, you know, he was, as a sophomore, he was third for the Heisman. I always thought he should have got the Heisman. The guy that got it was from Auburn. I forget his name. But he had a great career, and he was a senior, but he didn't have as good years. The senior year, Lorenzo was better, and that trophy, the Heisman, is sometimes a accumulation of your career rather than just that season. But Lorenzo was a great running back. Mandridge, best offensive lineman that we've had around here in a long, long, long time. Classiest, tough offensive center with class that's someday going to be a head football coach, Pat Shurmur, who now is with the Eagles, tight ends coach. Brilliant guy, Dean Altobelli, who interviewed for the Rhodes. And we had another guy that was considered for the Rhodes, Wozniak. Then the greatest kid that I offered to come as a walk-on, finally gave him a scholarship, ended up being all-world, Bobby Morris, who played a lot of pro football. Danny Enos, super college quarterback that had average ability, but he was just he made things happen, so you won. Being considered for, he's at Western Michigan now coaching the quarterbacks, being considered as a quality control guy with the Chicago Bears, you might even find out today. You know, the classic guys like Jim Morrissey, middle linebacker Shane Bulla. One great player that hasn't had much success since being drafted in the first round, who was a great player for us, Percy Snow. Alan Haller, great player for us. It's a sergeant on the campus police department now. We have about four or five of our ex-players that are policemen in Lansing. I don't know why I recruit so many guys that end up being policemen, but we do. Jim Miller, the quarterback, that he's with the Bears. He was a class guy. And John Miller, another one from a defensive back from not Orchard Lake, but Crisis coach just won another championship.
Is it Farmington?
Farmington Harrison, and Johnny Miller, and then the little wide receiver that's from the same school that sells Equitable Insurance now. Little black kid, short one.
Yeah, I remember. I know who you're talking about. But I can't.
Brilliant kid, smart kid, great student.
Milt the Thrill.
Mill the Thrill. That's who it is. Milt Coleman.
Yeah.
Yeah, Milt Coleman. The ones that jump out at you are the good players that were smart. Or they do at me, you know. Shurmur, Altobelli, Wozniak, Mill Coleman, Johnny Miller, Jim Miller, then you know, there's three. I had three walls up there. I had the first rounders, I had the academic All-Americans, and I had the regular All-Americans. Without a doubt, the best wall beyond is academic All-American. You look at those kids, what's going on? The worst wall is first rounders. Whew, that's a tough wall. A lot of disappointments there. And the All-Americans is some worked on, some didn't. Of course, you got some of those first-rounders on that All-American wall. But that academic thing, the Bobby Morris's and Shane Bullas, and then you had some great players like Andre Rison, who was a great wide receiver. Oh, what a pain in the neck. I mean, you earn your money to chase him around, trying to make him go to school and stay eligible and stay out of trouble. But that's your job. Your job is to take care and help these kids. And we bring in, not Michigan State, the whole country. We bring in some tough kids, tough street kids, and we expect them to come here and all of a sudden on this beautiful campus live by our rules. So they've been used to grabbing girls by the butt, to fighting, stealing, robbing, and they get their hands slapped. I mean, there's so many, what are you going to do? And they come here and they got to shape up. And they used to try to pound their head. After every practice, you get together as a team in a circle, you get on their knee, take a break. And this isn't Detroit, this isn't Cleveland, this is East Lansing. You better abide by these laws or they're going to lock your ass up. You can't walk in anybody's room, you can't touch anybody, you can't do those things. And it's a constant counseling on the field, day after day after day after day, and it sinks in a lot. And we save a lot of kids, and we lose some on the way. And when you're a coach and the kid gets off base, you got to take that. You got to take that for his grades. You're responsible for everything he does. When they get in the pros, it's different. No one holds the coaches responsible for their social or family life or whatever. Hell, it can come back. It comes back on me for 86. His senior year was 1986, a wide receiver from Flint, Mark Ingram. He has gotten in trouble. Since 86, I haven't had him. It still comes back on me in 2001. Mark Ingram just got picked up in Miami with counterfeit money and this shit. And when you recruit a kid, you got him for life as far as criticism goes. But I'm smart enough to know that, you know, what the hell, I couldn't do anything about it. Mark was a good kid. He's another first rounder. But you just can't beat in their head enough. But the ones that stand out in my mind are the ones that were good players and good students. And I know one thing, these coaches are doing a hell of a job trying to save a lot of kids. And they do. They save a lot of them. They lose a lot of them.
What about recruiting? What's that like as far as on a
recruiting's not as bad as it used to be. We used to have, we didn't have a national letter. Then we had one that was in May. Then it went to April. Now we're the first Wednesday in February, today.
Yeah.
So you have a dead period from a couple days for Christmas until about the middle of January, because you got the national convention, holidays, and all that. You basically only have recruiting weekends, 4 or 5. So it's real short. Recruiting is a humbling experience. I remember the day I was down at Dillard High School, Fort Lauderdale. Hayden Fry was there. Two grown men sitting there, standing up against the wall, watching a girls' basketball game, because the lady that coached the women's basketball is also the counselor that was having, this kid had no parents, so she was taking the place, so we had to wait to. So two grown men sitting there, watching that, and then my turn to go in and his turn to go in, trying to tell kids everything they want to hear. Very, very difficult to level with them. Yeah, you're good, and you're going to be a fine, maybe someday an All-American, maybe someday a pro, but you're not going to be able to make the team start to your sophomore year. Gone. I mean, if you level with them, tell them that. Some other guys tell them he's going to be All-World the first year, and they believe that. Quarterbacks, they all think, they all want to be doctors or engineers, and they're all going to start their freshman year, and they're all going to go to the NFL and sign a $15 million bonus. And that's their dreams, which are great. But it's hard to really level with them when they're going to play and how they're going to play. And they know your roster. They know everybody on it. Recruiting, like this one kid that Michigan State's recruiting now, well, Louisiana, Saban. At LSU, he's got that big basketball, the kid's from California, he's got that big basketball player from the Lakers. What's his name, the center?
Oh, right, Shaq.
Shaq calling him up because he went to LSU. And Shaq's got a job for him, which is illegal as hell. But you got to put up with times when guys go overboard, and you don't want to be in a position to start blowing whistles on people. They usually get caught themselves. But recruiting's not a lot of fun. Then it's calling them once a week, or if you want to talk to him more, then he's got to go to the coach's office, and the coach calls you, and then you talk to the coach, and then the coach puts a kid on. A lot of traveling. It's hard. Recruiting's a tough job. And the whole job is tough. And hell, they're on Bobby's ass. He's only been in there 1 year, and you know, people want to criticize for winning five games. Hell, that's all I won my first year.
How was it you selected him as an assistant?
Well, he had a reputation of being an excellent coach and recruiter. Well, as it ended up, he was a better coach than I anticipated even. He was super at that, and also recruiting. He was a lot more than I anticipated. But the guy's a good coach, and he's been real fair with his, you know, I know a lot about it because my son Pat's on the coaching staff. And he's good coach and a good recruiter. I think next year you'll see him have a pretty decent year.
What do you think about the Steve Smith Academic Center for